Broadcasting live from the Business Radio X studios in Atlanta, Georgia, it's time for Atlanta Business Radio, spotlighting the city's best businesses and the people who lead them.
Welcome to this very special edition of Atlanta Business Radio. It is our Atlanta's Most Trusted Advisors series, Stone Payton here producing, and we have our good friend and seasoned host, Miss Bonnie Buell Russick. How are you, babe?
I'm good. Seasoned. That's it. Something ought to be seasoned. It seems like we're not getting fall this year. So how's it going?
I am doing well. I'm really looking forward to this segment. This is a very interesting story, and I think we're going to have a lot of fun visiting with these folks.
Yeah, I'm really looking forward to it, too. It's a little bit different than what we typically do, but I heard Amy's story, and I've known Sandy for a long time, and I thought it was just so compelling that I really wanted to bring them on today and have the conversation and see what lessons we can learn from it, if any. But yes, today we have on the show, we have Amy Brown Williams and Sandy Wallach. I'll start with Sandy. He is a practicing criminal defense attorney. Been doing so over 20 years, which basically looks like he started when he was 10. And he has experience handling criminal matters in state and federal court at the trial and appellate levels. He received his law degree from Emory University and can be found at wallachlaw.com. And I'm going to let Sandy actually introduce Amy. And one of the reasons that we're here today is kind of that this case was just kind of somewhat unbelievable and fascinating. But one of the things I wanted to talk about too is, you know, lessons for business owners on if there's anything they can do to avoid winding up in a similar situation. So, Sandy, tell us a little bit about Amy.
Well, thank you. First of all, thanks for having us on, and thanks for including Amy. I think that I can't speak for her at least, but for me, it's special to have her here and to be able to share the story. Amy is a former client at this point. I represented Amy for approximately 6 to 7 years. And Amy was charged federally with bank fraud. And we had a week-long trial this August, and she was acquitted of all charges.
Wow. That's 6 to 7 years?
Yes. And I was actually not her first attorney. Has been a long, long travail for Amy.
Wow. So, Amy, tell us a little bit about what you're doing now. And then also, let's go back and kind of walk through this trial. Sure. And what happened.
Like Sandy, thank you for including me in this segment. What I'm doing now, I am working on a farm in South Georgia. I call it from the skyline of Atlanta seat to a tractor seat. And lessons learned. And one of the blogs that I'm going to create is how a farm saved my sanity and my life. Because when you're put through what I was put through, when you get charged with something that you did not do, you immediately kind of cave in emotionally, spiritually, somewhat physically. And the best thing that's ever happened was to whisk me out of the common and get me down to the uncommon and get my body, mind, and soul, and spirit back to the earth, back to the dirt, back to growing, planting seeds and watching them grow and harvesting them, which is a lesson in and of itself, business, life, spiritual, whatever. Mm-hmm. And so that's what I'm doing now. I went from being a 30-year seasoned mortgage banking professional to a farmer.
Wow, that's quite a change.
Quite a change.
So tell us a little bit about, you know, what you were doing, 10 years ago or so that we're talking about. And, you know, it sounds like it was a pretty thriving business.
It was.
And, you know, certainly it was a crazy time to be in the banking industry.
Totally.
So talk a little bit about what that was like.
I entered the mortgage banking business in 84. And in that day, women kind of went into mortgage banking as the secretaries.
Mm-hmm.
They were not really salespeople. And I wanted to be the out front lead salesperson. So I had to prove myself. I had one boss that gave me a chance. And he said, you've got 6 months. And you need to prove yourself. And I did. And so digging something out of the dirt is part of who I am as a person. And so built a reputation in Atlanta, more North Georgia, Gwinnett County, the area up there, of being an FHA expert. If anybody had a loan that they needed to get through FHA, they knew to come to me because I studied it like the back of my hand. Decided to go into business for myself, which is the American dream, isn't it?
Absolutely.
You know,
I did it.
you work for someone else and you pay your dues and you drive in the traffic and you raise your children and it's like, okay, it's my time to shine. So I opened up United International Mortgage Corporation when the economy was just booming. Money was prolific. Banks were handing it out like bubblegum. And so I opened the company and immediately started getting things thrown at me that I was even unaware of, to be honest with you. Lines of credit, hedge fund lines, things like that. So, and those are lessons that I'm sure we'll talk about, being prepared, called devastating success. And so...
I like that term. Yeah. I had not heard that. That's great.
Yeah. So the company grew, and as it grew, I brought on people to help me run it because no one person can run a business on all aspects. And we were able to close. I was the first woman in the Southeast United States to close a $50 million guidance line for the purpose of lending construction money for rehabilitation homes here in Atlanta, Georgia. So you see a house on North Druid Hills Road that's run down. An investor goes and purchases it. They need money to tear down the collateral and build it back. Banks do not like for you to tear down collateral. So I allowed that. So I allowed them to tear down that little brick bungalow and build back the McMansions that you see around Atlanta,
all
Georgia.
All over Atlanta, yes.
There you go. So I'm part of the McMansion effect.
We'll let that slide.
We'll let it slide. We will let it slide. So life was good. Mm-hmm. I had a really good, really good business. Very proud of what I did. Still am. Going through the trial has not changed my success and what I'm proud of doing. It just changed my outlook of success. And there's different terms for everybody.
Sure. Sure. So you're growing, you're thriving. Things are just gangbusters, it sounds like. And that was certainly a time when being in the, you know, real estate industry in whatever role it was very financially lucrative.
Yes.
So all things are going great. What happened?
Well, as we all know, the economy started doing some rumblings, probably earlier than we know. Now, looking back, it's easy to armchair quarterback.
Oh, sure.
And so now looking back, we started seeing the underlying of the volcano probably in late 06, early 07, when you start looking at some statistics.
That early.
But we did not see it because things were too good. And a lot of times you wear rose-colored glasses and you forget to clean them. And so we just kept business as usual. Mm-hmm. Why not? Things are booming. Let's hand out money. Let's get money in, hand it out. That was my business, in and out. With a rate of return.
Sure.
And so business is thriving. And then all of a sudden, I started seeing my customers be unable to pay me in a timely manner. So an example, I lend you $100,000. You make me payments every month of $1,000. I depend on your $1,000 to pay my bills.
Sure.
Well, you do that 50 million times, $50 million worth of times, and then 2 and 3 and 4 and 5 customers start failing to pay you, all of a sudden you're in a financial crisis. And some of those loans were very significant. 4 or 5 customers that I had, their payments every month were upwards of $20,000 because they were multi-million dollar projects. So you get 5 people defaulting on $20,000 a month, you're $100,000 in the hole every Monday morning.
Suddenly, it's hard to make payroll or pay your rent or just run your business.
Just run your business. Mm-hmm. Absolutely. And so as the economy began to spiral, so did I, as did many mom and pop shops. You know, I'm not a Bank of America, Wells Fargo, Washington Mutual. I was a mom and pop little Beaufort, Georgia lending institution. And when I started seeing my friends in the industry, the builders, other mortgage bankers, realtors start like, what in the world's going on? We all started scratching our head but still thinking this is just a blip. It's okay. We'll make it through. Being in the industry for so long, I made it through the SNL crisis. I made it through the dot-com crisis. And so I thought, well, I'll be able to ride this wave as well. Let's just tighten our belt up. You know, let's tighten our belt up on little things, stop eating out lunch quite as much. And, you know, let's see how we can save money here and there, and we'll ride this wave. Well, we all know that that was the worst downturn since the Great Depression in the late 20s, early 30s. Mm-hmm. And no one pretty much survived the little mom and pop shops.
But your case is different in that there were, you know, suddenly you're under investigation.
Yes.
And, you know, lots and lots of businesses went out, and it was absolutely a tragic time for so many people.
Right.
But you had this extra layer of, we're just going to say complication right now, maybe.
Sure, sure.
What brought all that on? How did that happen?
I had an employee who ran a branch for me, and I'll keep names and branch locations out of this. And unbeknownst to me, he was creating some fraud, not with my bank, but with another bank that I had no idea he had affiliation with. And so the FBI shows up at my office one morning on looking for information on him. And I fully cooperated, of course, got them anything and everything that they needed. And at that point, because my business was beginning to fail as well, they thought, well, let's just investigate the whole gamut. And that's how it got started.
Wow. So, Sandy, tell us a little bit about what, you know, your knowledge of what happened from there. You know, how, okay, an investigation starts, the FBI is on your doorstep, immediately you're sweating bullets, I would imagine. But, you know, there was nothing there to find. So right. How is it that we're sitting here today, many years later, talking about a case that drug on forever?
Well, the irony with all this and what Amy left out is not only did she cooperate with the authorities, with the FBI, with the FDIC, and with the U.S. Attorney's Office in regards to the investigation of that other person, she actually got an email back that thanked her for going above and beyond in her assistance. And within months, that same prosecutor, that same assistant U.S. attorney, then alerted Amy's corporate counsel that Amy was a target of investigation. So essentially, at the same time that they're shaking Amy's hand and saying, hey, thank you so much for all your help and for everything that you've done, they're also saying, oh, but we're investigating you criminally, too, and we think that you committed crimes. There is nothing you can do to avoid that as a business owner.
Yeah.
There is nothing that you can do to keep from being wrongfully accused of something. So in this situation, Amy is notified that she's a target. She gets counsel, and it all starts at that point. And we're talking about late 2008, early 2009. And at that point, it really just dragged on. The U.S. Attorney's Office played a game of poker with Amy and wanted her to roll over and take a plea and admit to guilt, admit to doing something that she didn't do. And Amy dug her heels in and said that she wasn't going to do that. And the U.S. Attorney's Office wasn't ready to move on the case. And it sat and it sat and it sat for a number of years. And it changed hands between prosecutors. At the actual original two of the prosecutors who originally touched the case, longtime prosecutors, retired during this whole process. The initial attorneys on the case moved on, and ultimately found me in 2010. And about 2 years later, out of the blue, I got an email from a prosecutor, from a new assistant U.S. attorney, new to this case, letting me know that he was going to indict the case and just wanted to let me know. And so then at that point, he and I started conversations, and we spent a good year going back and forth with Amy and I, essentially trying to convince him that the case should not go forward. And ultimately, he felt that that there was crime that was committed by Amy and that he was going to indict the case.
So the official charge was it fraud?
Was bank fraud.
Bank fraud.
Bank
okay.
fraud. And the allegations were that Amy ultimately, and this was a couple years because the charges grew as the case lingered on, but ultimately, in 2016, when we went to trial, it was that Amy had lines of credit with two different banks, and that she took that money was dispersed from that line of credit to her business, UIM, for two specific construction projects, and that instead of being used for those construction projects, it was used for other purposes, personal use by Amy, and other uses by the business.
So what made them think that that was taking place?
The I guess from their end of it, it's looking at bank records, it's looking at checks, it's looking at payments, and it's following the trail that way. And money did go all over the place. You know, in these instances, we had something that was very different going on because there's different agreements with each of the banks. And so one of the issues was, as to one of the particular banks, whether the agreement actually limited UIM's use of the funds to begin with. Because if the agreement didn't limit it, then you know, UIM and Amy's allowed to use it for whatever purpose that they want it to. Mm-hmm. And so it became, essentially interpretation of the contract, interpretation of the bank fraud statute. And then there becomes a factual issue as to, you know, what really happened. Within all of that, there has to be a criminal intent that's proven. There has to be an intent to deceive, an intent to defraud. And I think ultimately what the jury found in listening to all the evidence and listening to the witnesses and everything that was presented was at no time did Amy have any intent to deceive or to defraud either of the banks, that she was conducting business, and that just because ultimately she wasn't able to pay back the money from the lines of credit didn't mean that she committed fraud.
Okay. Right. And my understanding too is that there was one of your employees that was testifying against you or something. That's kind of one of the reasons why it kept, it wasn't settled before trial, correct?
Right. Well, the way for it to be settled before trial is one of two ways. The prosecutor's office can decide to dismiss it, and the U.S. attorney's office rarely does that. I consider them to be like a little bulldog that once they get a hold of your pant leg, they just don't like to let go in that office. And they have enormous resources. And they will continue to investigate and continue to go after it and use leverage because federal sentencing is very excessive and harsh, and they will use that to their advantage. And that's what they tried to do here with Amy. And they can choose to dismiss it, or the defendant, in this case, Amy, can choose to enter a plea. Gotcha. And Amy wasn't willing to do that.
Mm-hmm. Entering a plea to me meant that I had to lie.
Yeah.
I had to lie to say I did something wrong when I didn't. And so Sandy and I had that heart-to-heart conversation, and I said, as much as I want this to go away, because living under that, I can't even describe the emotions, you just want to wake up one morning and it be gone, and it be over. And often your thoughts go, well, if I can just do this and it'll go away, then why not? But doing that meant that I had to enter into an agreement that admitted that my intent, my heart, my whole reason for being in business was to have ill-gotten gain. And that is not who I am. That's not anywhere in my core. And I told Sandy, I said, I can't lie, you know? Mm-hmm. I can't lie and say, I'm going to enter into a plea and say, yeah, I did all these things wrong just to get relief. And I think sometimes we do that, you know? And so I told Sandy, I said, I've got to prove myself, and thank God for Sandy Wallach.
And I can see how that would be tempting, you know,
sure,
after years and years and years. And, you know, statistically, the chances of somebody winning a federal case in this sort of situation is pretty low, correct?
Very low. Very low. It would be like me saying, let's get in a car and we're going to take a drive to Atlanta, Georgia from Gwinnett County down I-85. And you have between a 5 and a 10% chance of surviving that car ride.
Wow.
Those were my odds. Mm-hmm. I had a 5 to 10% chance of walking out there, walking out of that courtroom, a free woman. But I knew in my heart, I knew that I needed to take the chance because I knew the truth, period. No mm-hmm. other reason. I knew the truth. But often jurors sometimes don't see that, or maybe counsel doesn't present it in a way that they do see it, or there's many different reasons that that could happen. But, you know, when you've got a 90% chance of being beat, you go into the game with, it's the David and Goliath, you know, you go into the game with 5 stones and you're facing the giants, but you have to go into the game.
Wow. All
right. So I got a quick question. Win, lose, or draw, aren't you out money when you have to go through this process? I mean, Sandy's got to be paid. You got to,
Oh, absolutely.
So that's another layer.
That's a whole nother layer. Well, yeah. Not only when the economy tanked in 07 and 08, did I financially lose everything that I'd worked for 30 years of my life.
Yeah.
And I was, you know, doing okay for myself. I was a very independent person. I was a very self-sufficient person. I took care of a lot of people because I was taught that when much is given, much is required. And so I went through that emotional roller coaster of being financially wealthy to being so broke that I was rolling pennies and quarters and dimes. And I mean, literally, I'm not talking figuratively, I'm talking literally, to feed myself and to buy gas in my car. Now, thank God for family, and friends. And so I never walked down the street with a hobo pack on my back, but I had to roll change because I was so independent. I was not going to ask anybody for a $20 bill to put gas in my car. I was going to dig in every drawer and find every penny and do it myself. And so I went through the emotional loss or the financial loss, and that's an emotional headache in and of itself. And then now I'm facing criminal charges on something that I did not do. And so, yes, the money aspect of it is unbelievable. Now, Sandy was court appointed to me. So personally, I did not have to pay him. He did not get a fraction of what he deserves for representing me. And so there's not enough money in this world, in my opinion, to pay Sandy Waller. But yeah, the money aspect of it's huge.
And he was your third attorney, though, too.
He was. So when Terry Franzine first, my corporate counsel, called and said, "You're a target, get an attorney," I was still able to work in the mortgage banking industry and I was employed. And so my partner and I made the choice to go get a really, really good attorney. And her rate was $500 an hour. And the rate for the forensic was $150 an hour. So I had to earn $650 an hour to just pay them.
Wow.
Ouch. Yeah. Now, is there some mechanism in place to recoup that when you do come out of it and you're found not guilty or anything? Or that's just...
Nope. Nothing.
Nothing.
Oh, my.
So all of that is reasons why folks often enter guilty pleas. It's the emotion. Yeah. It's the emotional toll. It's the years that you've already had it living under it. And so by the time it comes around, you're willing just to do whatever you need to get it done. It's the financial expense of it. And all of those things work against the defendant. And it's somewhat similar in for state court and state charges, but particularly for someone facing federal charges, the government's unlimited in terms of its resources. The U.S. Attorney's Office doesn't have to factor money in to decide how it's going to handle a case. It just looks tunnel vision in terms of what it thinks it needs to do. Whether that's good or bad, that is the way it is. And so for any defendant, you're facing such an uphill battle.
Wow. Man, that'd be enough to turn you criminal next time around.
I think
we put an innocent person in jail and, I mean, they're in that environment. Living through that, I mean, wow.
It's almost like you need to rob a bank to pay the attorneys to cover the cost.
To cover the cost.
Commit a real crime. You need to pay for the one you didn't
exactly.
commit.
Right.
Man, you are one strong person.
Well, thank you.
Wow.
that's incredible. So I guess what was at trial? I mean, obviously you were absolutely innocent and going to, you know, nearly go to your grave proving that.
Mm-hmm. Correct.
You know, what was the defense at trial? How did you argue this case?
Well, the defense was that she never had fraudulent intent, that she never intended to deceive. And so, part of that, as I mentioned earlier, was legal interpretation of the contracts. And that's something not typically done in a criminal case. It's not something that we typically have in your usual criminal case. But that's what we had here. And that's something more you would see in a civil case.
Mm-hmm.
But that was one aspect of it, is what did the agreements require? And then the second and the important aspect to it was what was Amy's frame of mind? What did she have in her head when she entered into those agreements? What did she have in her head when she was conducting business? And what was clear throughout all of the witnesses, the government's witnesses, through the documents that came in, was there was nothing to show that she ever intended to deceive the banks, that she ever intended to defraud the banks and put one past them. The banks went in, they had their eyes open. They knew what Amy's business was. Amy's customers were not necessarily the folks with the best credit. She was a hard money lender, and the folks who came to her didn't have great credit. And that's why they needed an Amy. That's why they needed United International Mortgage. And the banks knew it wasn't something that they weren't aware of. The banks were making a lot of money, and they were more than happy to do business with UIM because of that. And it was important for the jury to hear that. And some of the things that came out at trial was the government wanted to make it out that all the banks went under because of United International Mortgage and Amy Williams. And that the builders...
Oh my gosh, you have a lot of power.
I do, don't I?
And that the builders involved all went bankrupt because of United International Mortgage and Amy Williams. And as to both of the builders and both the banks, what we were able to show is that, you know, the part that Amy had to do with in UIM was just a small percentage for them.
It was a fraction of a percentage.
You know, we're talking about in one of the banks, I believe the numbers were, was a $5 million. If the whole thing was lost, and it wasn't, but if the whole loan to UIM was lost, it was $5 million. And according to the FDIC, at the time that they took over the bank, the bank owed over $30 million, had over $30 million in losses. So, you know, you can't look at that and say, well, it's all her fault. And that's really what the government, that is exactly what the government put in front of the jury. And so at some point, I think the jury looks at it and says, you know, that BS,
what?
That's just, that's just not the way it is. And thankfully we had a jury that really was able to see through what the government was putting out there and was able to see this case for what it was. And that is that it was business. And certainly you can go back and look at it, and the banks would do things differently, and Amy would do things differently. The builders would, we all would. But at the time, nobody was committing a crime. Right. Everybody was just conducting business, whether it was good decisions or bad decisions. It was just business.
But it was a jury trial. Yes. So you've got human beings, one or two or three of which may have been through their own, you know, set of challenges through this time. They may have been facing some foreclosure or something, and they're watching the news every night and the evil lenders, you know, had to think through all that. Now, are you allowed in that setting to talk about the plea deals that were offered and turned down as like?
No, that doesn't come into it. Deals don't come into it. But one of the things that we do in terms of, you know, the jury and who's out there and what their experiences are, is that's the jury selection process.
Yeah.
And the judge gave us, I think, very appropriate leeway to go into those aspects, because that was a tough time for everybody. And, you know, whether you were a renter, whether you're a business owner, whether you own your house and took out mortgages, you know, we've all been through it. We all were touched by it some way or another. And there were some people who had strong emotions to it. And thankfully, because this doesn't always happen, they were open and honest about it. And they came and said, you know what, Judge, I'm probably not the person to be sitting on this case. Because this is what I do for a living, or because this is my experience. Exactly. I've been through this, or I've been through that. And you know what? I can't put that aside and not have that influence how I'm going to view it and how I'm sitting here right now looking at this case. And so those were jurors, potential jurors who did the right thing and said, Judge, I need you to know this. And the judge said, you know what? I agree. And you know, you go on about your day and you're done here. Thank you very much.
Right.
Wow. So as business owners out there, I'm sitting here as a business owner going, I don't see a whole lot that you could have done different. You know, you hired a really good, reputable attorney.
Right.
Who, you know, wound up breaking you, you know, financially.
Right.
You know, what advice do you have, either one of you, for, you know, business owners who to avoid this sort of situation, or if, God forbid, you're, you know, faced with some sort of FBI at your door or IRS at your door, or a governmental agency, you know, what can you do?
Well, I'll say it from the lawyer perspective. There's nothing that you can do to avoid somebody wrongly accusing you of a crime. But you do need to Boy Scout it. And that is to say that, you know, as a business owner or even as an employee, you just need to document things the best you can. You need to keep records. You need to keep hold of things so that if something comes up and you need to go 10 years back to look at agreements or to look at financial records, you have the ability to do that. I'm a business owner, and you know, I don't always run my business that way. And so it's a reminder, you know, and for our personal, you know, financial records as well, it's just a reminder that, you know, you never know what's coming around the corner and we all just need to be ultra careful. And the other thing is that the first sign of anything, any investigation, anybody looking at you from law enforcement is you need to retain counsel, and you need to retain counsel who's experienced in whatever the area is and knows what they're doing.
Right. And I can't agree with Sandy. That was the first thing that came to my mind was documentation. And that's one thing that I think Sandy found that I was really good at is I had saved everything. We had backed up my servers, and I can't tell you how important that is to back up your servers so that if anywhere, any employee decides to go and erase anything, you've got it backed up on a thumb drive or an external hard drive. I used to call it my black box. And I mean, I think I even slept with the black box worried I was going to lose it, you know, because it had everything about my company, emails, financials, you name it, it had it on there. And so when Sandy and the team that he so skillfully put together said, find me this, it may have taken me 2 or 3 or 4 days, because you're talking 10 years of a business records, every email, every document, but it was there. And I have told my family, my friends, I don't care, everywhere I go, I'm like, document, 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 save it. Even if it's a scratch piece of paper where you've taken notes and you've written something down about a conversation you had at lunch one day with someone who's offering you some type of deal for your business, you write it down so that you can go back to that. And then the other thing is, I'm a very trusting, naive person. My family will tell you my biggest quality is also my biggest weakness. If you tell me the sky is purple today, I'm not even going to look up. I'm going to believe you. And so when you hire, you have to have a little bit of cynicism to make sure that you just kind of go behind them. And I didn't do that. I trusted some of the people that I hired exclusively. And so I just, you have to know what's happening under your nose. But when you run a big business, that's extremely difficult. It's extremely difficult. Those are some things that I say is don't be naive. Don't turn a blind eye. Like Sandy says, the first minute of rumbling, hire counsel, hire Sandy Wallet, hire him to get, you know, to just put out there, hey, this is, I hear it. May not ever come to fruition, but I hear it. And, but documentation is by far, I can't stress that enough, because that was what literally was able to give Sandy the strategy that he needed, was my ability to produce documents.
And just to come back to what Amy was talking about, one of the important things for us was, because Amy hired counsel right away, despite the fact that, you know, it was too expensive for her to keep with that counsel, they went through everything with a fine-tooth comb. And so years later, thank goodness, when we needed, you know, when we finally got to trial in 2016, the work that they did in 2009 was invaluable. We had all of that. And so everything, you know, because she jumped on it and had counsel who jumped on it right away, they had all those records and they retained them. And, you know, Amy had boxes that were in her basement and in warehouses. I had at least 20 banker boxes in my office, in addition to the file cabinets, in addition to everything that we kept online. And we had a team. And so we kept everything electronically on a Dropbox file that we could all share and communicate with each other. But it was invaluable to have all that work done on the early side. Mm-hmm. And as Amy mentioned, fortunately, we were able to get funds and get a team together. And we had an investigator, John Schmarkey, a forensic accountant, Jim Hart, and a bank, what I refer to as a banking consultant, mm-hmm. a consultant in the knowledgeable in the industry, who was Phil Robertson, who assisted throughout. And they were invaluable in the process mm-hmm. as well.
Totally.
Wow.
Those four gentlemen, Sandy and the three that he mentioned, held me together when I wanted to just literally fall apart. And I don't even know the words to say about how important it is to have crutches under your armpits when you're facing something like this. And part of those crutches are the team that you surround yourself with. And then, of course, family and friends that stick by your side.
I can't imagine going through that. I want to go back to one thing that you had mentioned, and you were talking about hiring.
Yes.
You say you were a little more trusting than you probably should be.
Yes.
If you could go back and ask certain questions or, you know, do certain investigations or things like that to make sure that the people that you hired were the people you thought they were, what would you do?
Well, I think most importantly, I would make sure that they were qualified for the position, that just because they have a certain diploma may not mean that they are qualified to do that certain role. And then I think I would check more into the personal aspects of their life. You know, there's certain questions that you can ask people about their life, in my opinion, that will give you an idea of what's really and truly inside their heart. One of those questions, and you're all going to think this is a crazy question, but one of the first things I always ask people in a very nonchalant way is, tell me about your mom. Because how sometimes you feel about your mom is, and or your parent or your mother figure, is a good insight to what's in your heart. And when someone, when I say, gosh, how do you and your mom get along? If they ever say, I can't stand her, then I know that down deep inside, there's something that stems from way back that's going to eventually come out. To me, that's one of the most important questions I ask a lot of people. And unfortunately, one of the close hires that I had inside, probably to this day, has a horrible relationship with her mother, which fed over into a horrible relationship with customers and clients, which head over to a horrible relationship with her own daughter. And so when you start looking at all those elements, everything is friction. Everything is friction. And when you're running a business, you don't need friction. You need clear, concise thought. You need someone to sit down and be clear and concise with their work, and none of this on the telephone pole fussing and cussing their mother out. And so that's, it's crazy, but my grandmother taught me that. And she said, find a person to walk the journey of life with who loves their mother and loves the earth. And if somebody loves the earth and takes care of the earth and takes care of their mom, that's a good soul.
Interesting. I guess there's a challenge there. You know, I can absolutely see asking some of these questions. And you're right. With people that have a lot of drama in their personal lives, that tends to come into the office and just create a dramatic atmosphere. And
totally.
I'm way not into that at all.
Right.
But you also have to be careful with what you're legally allowed to ask.
Absolutely.
And things like that too. So I could even see, you know, working with an HR consultant or somebody that knows those lines and how to do that would be an important person to bring in as a business owner too.
Totally agree with that. Bringing in an HR specialist, whether you're a small business or a large business, to me is critical because they know the right questions. They've been through the studies. They've studied psychology and they know all of that instead of just saying, oh, you've got you look good on paper.
Yeah.
Yeah.
It's easy to look good on paper,
right.
I think.
Right. It's like going through Macy's and seeing a pair of pants. Sometimes it looks the best on the hanger.
Yeah. Yeah.
Leave it on the hanger.
Yeah. The mannequin can wear it.
That's
well.
That's right. The mannequin can wear it well.
Those of us that have a little extra, it's not going to look as good on us.
Right.
So I guess, you know, did you have anything else to add to this?
I'm just blown away, fascinating
story.
At your personal strength and character, I am just absolutely amazed. And I do think you're blessed, and the business community is blessed to have an attorney of the caliber of Sandy Wallach. So this has just been a really interesting and inspiring story to me, with a little bit of, appropriate Halloween scary boo.
Fear.
But I want to be constructive with it. And, Lee Cantor and I, as business owners of the Business Radio X Network, I think we ought to have a conversation. Let's really get a little more disciplined about documenting what we're doing. Mm-hmm. And as we continue to grow the company, one of the ways we're growing is kind of company stores. So when we're actually hiring, let's get some professional counsel in here on conducting those interviews, because I'm a lot like you, I think, in those, someone tells me they can do something, I want to believe in them. And it hasn't been in the past much of a gauntlet to get Stone to hire you.
Right.
You know, I'm like, hey, this sounds great, man. We're going to have help a lot of folks, make a lot of money. Let's go.
Right.
And I think it's time to grow up as a company a little bit for us and be a little more disciplined. So this has been very instructive
for me. For me as well. I guess before we close up, any advice, parting advice that you have, and then want to give Sandy an opportunity to talk about his business a little bit and, you know, how to get in touch with him.
Well, I think parting advice for me would be the strength comes from within. And when you're faced with challenges, a lot of people have come up to me and said, I don't know how you got through this. I would never be able to do this. And I'm like, yes, you would. Because when the strength's there, you have it. You know, not every day do we have to flip a car off of somebody that's been in a car accident, but when the strength's needed to do so, figuratively speaking, it's there. And so you have to positively maintain a mindset every day. And thank goodness for Paige, which is my partner, my family, my children, that just constantly, you know, said on my weakest days, you know, come on. We're not going to let you fall. We're going to drag you through this portion of your life. So to me, it's important on a personal level to surround yourself by some of the most incredibly compassionate, wonderful people. And then, like you said, Stone, on a business side, grow up and do the right things, take the right steps in building a business, you know, the strategy that you need. And a lot of time that's outside eyes looking in instead of inside eyes looking out, because like you and I, it's fun. Let's go to work. Let's all do this and that. Let's go to lunch together. And often that becomes an issue. And so running a business is often not, you're not the most popular person in the building, but you have to make those tough decisions. So,
well. And Sandy?
I've been practicing criminal defense law for over 20 years, and I love it. And it's always what I wanted to do. And what keeps me humming and what keeps me so happy with it and so proud of what I do is people like Amy. It is so easy to do what I do when I have clients that are like her. And that's not because she's not guilty and we want a trial. While that certainly helps and feels a lot better than the alternative, I represent people who are guilty or not guilty, and whether they are guilty or not guilty isn't the determining factor. But what I look for and what inspires me is people. And people come to me because they have a problem. Whether they've done something or not, they've been accused of it. And that's the issue that they're dealing with. And they come to me for help. And when I have a client who is such an inspiration as Amy is, and is just willing to fight and willing to say, I didn't do it, and I'm not going to say I did, and is willing to go through that for that number of years and be active in her defense and really care about what's going on and what I'm doing to help her, as well as just asking how I'm doing. If I'm working late nights and I'm you know, coming in looking a little disheveled and straggling, you know, Amy's right there to make sure I've got something to eat at trial, or right there to make sure that I'm doing okay. And so it's easy to represent an Amy Williams. It is a joyful job in the rare instances where you do get to represent Amy Williams and you go to trial and you hear those two magic words at the end of not guilty. And that is in the work that I do that it doesn't happen often, but it is so special when it does. And I was so proud to just be a part of it, of her moment, and be there with her for that.
And that was an incredible moment.
I'll bet it was.
That was an incredible moment.
Ooh, I think, but just pass out cold.
I did, something. I think. I just remember, I asked Sandy, I leaned in and said, can I hold your hand? And he said, sure. And so I think with every not guilty, I probably squeezed a finger more off because I just remember that when it came up on as to count three, I was breathless at that time. Mm. I literally was breathless. And I just thought, I'm going to pass out. And when I heard those two words, my whole body just laid over on the table because I was breathless. And just my family and friends cried and I cried. I think my dad started clapping, and you know, I wanted to go over to each of the jurors and the judge and just thank them. Of course I didn't, I couldn't, but I think I remember mouthing to each of them, thank you so much for their attention. Their attention that week was unbelievable. It's a tough case. It's not your typical case. And their attention to Sandy was just so refreshing. And I can't, if they're listening, I can't thank them enough either for being attentive to me and to the case. And now, you know, it's the next step. But for me, it's important that people understand the value of Sandy Wallach, not just as an attorney. And I think I would feel the same way. Now, of course, I'll never know, thank the good Lord above, but I would feel the same way if things had not turned out differently. Empathy, compassion, a strategist beyond words, just a very articulate deliverer of facts to the jury so they could understand it in a common language. So if you ever need that, he is by far the go-to guy.
Yes, yes. He and while he was working on your case, some people may be familiar with Sandy because the Atlanta Public Schools case,
yes,
which we heard about ad nauseum forever, his client was the one that was acquitted in case as well. So
back to back.
Sandy definitely has a pretty amazing track record behind him. So
yes, he does.
Well, thank you both.
Yeah. Absolutely. This was good.
Yeah. I think that's a wrap. This has been incredible. Thank you all. Until next time, this is Stone Payton for Bonnie Buell Russick. Our guest today, Miss Amy Williams and rock star attorney Sandy Wallach, and everyone here at the Business Radio X family saying we'll see you next time on Atlanta Business Radio.